This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati presents The Science World. Welcome to The Science World, a half hour of news and commentary in science, technology, and medicine. On today's program, AI is learning what it means to be alive. Is social media addictive? And brain activity at the moment of death. I'm Steve Klaney. First, AI, or artificial intelligence, is learning what it means to be alive, by Carl Zimmer in the March 10th New York Times. In 1889, a French doctor named François Gilbert Viot climbed down from a mountain in the Andes, drew blood from his arm, and inspected it under a microscope. Dr. Viot's red blood cells, which ferry oxygen, had surged 42%. He had discovered a mysterious power of the human body. When it needs more of these crucial cells, it can make them on demand. In the early 1900s, scientists theorized that a hormone was the cause. They called the theoretical hormone erythropoietin, or red maker in Greek. 7 decades later, researchers found actual erythropoietin after filtering 670 gallons of urine. And about 50 years after that, biologists in Israel announced they'd found a rare kidney cell that makes the hormone when oxygen drops too low. It's called the Norn cell, named after the Norse deities who were believed to control human fate. It took humans 134 years to discover Norn cells. Last summer, computers in California discovered them on their own in just 6 weeks. The discovery came about when researchers at Stanford programmed the computers to teach themselves biology. The computers ran an artificial intelligence program similar to ChatGPT, the popular bot that became fluent with language after training on billions of pieces of text from the internet. But the Stanford researchers trained their computers on raw data about millions of real cells and their chemical and genetic makeup. The researchers didn't tell the computers what these measurements meant. They didn't explain that different kinds of cells have different biochemical profiles. They did not define which cells catch light in our eyes, for example, or which ones make antibodies. The computers crunched the data on their own, creating a model of all the cells based on their similarity to each other in a vast multidimensional space. When the machines were done, they had learned an astonishing amount. They could classify a cell they'd never seen before as one of over 1,000 different types. One of those was the Norn cell. That's remarkable because nobody ever told the model that a Norn cell exists in the kidney, said Yuri Leskovitz, a computer scientist at Stanford who trained the computers. The software is one of several new AI-powered programs, known as foundation models, that are setting their sights on the fundamentals of biology. The models aren't simply tidying up the information that biologists are collecting. They're making discoveries about how genes work and how cells develop. As the models scale up with ever more laboratory data and computing power, scientists predict that they'll start making more profound discoveries. They may reveal secrets about cancer and other diseases. They may figure out recipes for turning one kind of cell into another. A vital discovery about biology that otherwise would not have been made by the biologists, I think we're going to see that at some point, said Dr. Eric Topol, the director of the Scripps Research Translational Institute. Just how far they will go is a matter of debate. While some skeptics think the models are going to hit a wall, more optimistic scientists believe that foundation models will even tackle the biggest biological question of them all. What separates life from non-life? Biologists have long sought to understand how the different cells in our bodies use genes to do the many things we need to stay alive. About a decade ago, researchers started industrial-scale experiments to fish out genetic bits from individual cells. They recorded what they found in catalogs, or cell atlases, that swelled with billions of pieces of data. Dr. Christina Theodoros, a medical resident at Boston Children's Hospital, was reading about a new kind of AI model made by Google engineers in 2017 for language translations. The researchers provided the model with millions of sentences in English, along with their translations into German and French. The model developed the power to translate sentences it hadn't seen before. Dr. Theodoros wondered if a similar model could teach itself to make sense of the data in cell atlases. In 2021, she struggled to find a lab that might let her try to build one. There was a lot of skepticism that this approach would work at all, she said. Sherry Liu, a computational biologist at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, gave her a shot. Dr. Theodoros pulled data from 106 published human studies, which collectively included 30 million cells, and fed it all into a program she called GeneFormer. The model gained a deep understanding of how our genes behave in different cells. It predicted, for example, that shutting down a gene called TEAD4 in a certain type of heart cell would severely disrupt it. When her team put the prediction to the test in real cells, called cardiomyocytes, the beating of the heart cells grew weaker. In another test, she and her colleagues showed GeneFormer heart cells from people with defective heartbeat rhythms, as well as from healthy people. Then we said, "Now tell us what changes we need to happen to the unhealthy cells to make them healthy," said Dr. Theodoros, who now works as a computational biologist at the Gladstone Institutes in San Francisco. GeneFormer recommended reducing the activity of four genes that had never before been linked to heart disease. Dr. Theodoros' team followed the model's advice, knocking down each of the four genes. In two out of the four cases, the treatment improved how the cells contracted. The Stanford team got into the foundation model business after helping to build one of the biggest databases of cells in the world, known as CellX Gene. Beginning in August, the researchers trained their computers on the 33 million cells in the database, focusing on a type of genetic information called messenger RNA. They also fed the model the three-dimensional structures of proteins, which are the products of genes. Computers learn how to classify over 1,000 types of cells based on how their genes turn on and off. From these data, the model, known as Universal Cell Embedding, or UCE, calculated the similarity among cells, grouping them into more than 1,000 clusters according to how they use their genes. The clusters corresponded to types of cells discovered by generations of biologists. UCE also taught itself some important things about how the cells develop from a single fertilized egg. For example, UCE recognized that all the cells in the body can be grouped according to which of three layers they came from in the early embryo. It essentially rediscovered developmental biology, said Stephen Quake, a biophysicist at Stanford who helped develop UCE. The model was also able to transfer its knowledge to new species. Presented with the genetic profile of cells from an animal that it had never seen before, a naked mole rat, say, UCE could identify many of its cell types. You can bring a completely new organism, chicken, frog, fish, whatever, you can put it in and you'll get something useful out, Dr. Liskovitz said. After UCE discovered the Norrin cells, Dr. Liskovitz and his colleagues looked in the CellX gene database to see where they'd come from. While many of the cells had been taken from kidneys, some had come from lungs or other organs. It was possible, the researchers speculated, that previously unknown Norrin cells were scattered across the body. Dr. Katalin Sushtak, a physician scientist at the University of Pennsylvania who studies Norrin cells, said that the finding whetted her curiosity. "I want to check these cells," she said. She's skeptical that the model found true Norrin cells outside the kidneys, since the erythropoietin hormone hasn't been found in other places. But the new cells may sense oxygen, as Norrin cells do. In other words, UCE may have discovered a new type of cell before biologists did. Just like ChatGPT, biological models sometimes get things wrong. Kasia Kedzierska, a computational biologist at the University of Oxford, and her colleagues recently gave GeneFormer and another foundation model, SCGPT, a battery of tests. They presented the models with cell atlases they hadn't seen before and had them perform tasks such as classifying the cells into types. The models performed well on some tasks, but in other cases they fared poorly compared with simpler computer programs. Dr. Kedzierska said she had great hopes for the models, but that for now, they shouldn't be used out of the box without a proper understanding of their limitations. Dr. Liskovitz said that the models were improving as scientists trained them on more data. But compared with ChatGPT's training on the entire internet, the latest cell atlases offer only a modest amount of information. "I'd like an entire internet of cells," he said. More cells are on the way as bigger cell atlases come online, and scientists are gleaning different types of data from each of the cells in those atlases. Some scientists are cataloging the molecules that stick to genes or taking photographs of cells to eliminate the precise location of these proteins. All of that information will allow foundation models to draw lessons about what makes cells work. Scientists are also developing tools that let foundation models combine what they're learning on their own with what flesh and blood biologists have already discovered. The idea would be to connect the findings in thousands of published scientific papers to the databases of cell measurements. With enough data and computing power, scientists say they may eventually create a complete mathematical representation of a cell. "That's going to be hugely revolutionary for the field of biology," said Bo Wang, a computational biologist at the University of Toronto and the creator of SCGPT. "With this virtual cell," he speculated, "it would be possible to predict what a real cell would do in any situation. Scientists could run entire experiments on their computers rather than in petri dishes." Dr. Quake suspects that foundation models will learn not just about the kinds of cells that currently reside in our bodies, but also about kinds of cells that could exist. He speculates that only certain combinations of biochemistry can keep a cell alive. Dr. Quake dreams of using foundation models to make a map showing the realm of the possible, beyond which life cannot exist. "I think these models are going to help us get some really fundamental understanding of the cell, which is going to provide some insight into what life really is," Dr. Quake said. Having a map of what's possible and impossible to sustain life might also mean that scientists could actually create new cells that don't yet exist in nature. The foundation model might be able to concoct chemical recipes that transform ordinary cells into new extraordinary ones. Those new cells might devour plaque and blood vessels, or explore a diseased organ to report back on its condition. "It's very fantastic voyage-ish," Dr. Quake admitted, "but who knows what the future's going to hold?" If foundation models live up to Dr. Quake's dreams, they'll also raise a number of new risks. On Friday, more than 80 biologists and AI experts signed a call for the technology to be regulated so that it can't be used to create new biological weapons. Such a concern might apply to new kinds of cells produced by the models. Privacy breaches could happen even sooner. Researchers hope to program personalized foundation models that would look at an individual's unique genome and the particular way that it works in cells. That new dimension of knowledge could reveal how different versions of genes affect the way cells work. But it could also give the owners of a foundation model some of the most intimate knowledge imaginable about the people who donated their DNA and cells to science. Some scientists have their doubts about how far foundational models will make it down the road to a fantastic voyage, however. The models are only as good as the data they're fed. Making an important new discovery about life may depend on having data on hand that we haven't figured out how to collect. We might not even know what data the models need. "They might make some new discoveries of interest," said Sarah Walker, a physicist at Arizona State University who studies the physical basis of life, "but ultimately they're limited when it comes to fundamental advances," she says. Still, the performance of foundation models has already led their creators to wonder about the role of human biologists in a world where computers make important insights on their own. Traditionally, biologists have been rewarded for creative and time-consuming experiments that encumber some of the workings of life. But computers may be able to see those workings in a matter of weeks, days, or even hours by scanning billions of cells for patterns we can't see. I'm going to force a complete rethink of what we consider creativity, Dr. Creek said. Professors should be very, very nervous. Next, is social media addictive? Digital Detox Study Suggests Not, by Sean Cummings in the November 8th Science Online. A week of reduced social media usage neither increased nor decreased people's desire to get back online, a new study finds. The lack of craving to return to social media platforms such as Instagram and X, formerly Twitter, suggests that for most people, the use of social media may not be truly addictive, the authors argue. Some experts remain skeptical, however. It's a really well-done study, says Mariek van den Abela, a communication scientist at Ghent University, who is not involved in the research. Because people often frame excessive social media use in terms of addiction, she says, the idea of detoxing from Instagram and X, as one might from drugs or alcohol, has garnered attention as well. What do we see in the study? That actually does not work very well, van den Abela says. As social media usage has exploded over the past decade, public discourse has fixated on its potential to erode our emotional well-being and even to addict us to likes and follows. Some research has shown excessive use correlates with increased depression and anxiety. In rare cases, it can resemble substance use disorders such as drug dependence or pathological gambling, complete with withdrawal-like symptoms such as cravings, loneliness, and dark moods when users go cold turkey. The results have not been conclusive. Some studies have indicated that instead of suffering withdrawal symptoms, people feel happier during a digital detox, whereas others have found no change. For this reason and others, some experts hesitate to apply the language of addiction to social media usage. We're hugely dependent on these devices, van den Abela says, but that doesn't make us pathologically addicted. To probe how abstaining from social media impacts emotional health and whether doing so reveals any signs of addiction, Niklas Eason and Michael Wadsley, psychologists at Durham University, asked 51 student volunteers to swear off social media for 1 week, but didn't restrict their access to social media, leaving the results up to the honor system. Throughout that week, surveys recorded how much time subjects spent on different smartphone apps and their emotional well-being. The duo also put subjects through lab exercises similar to those used in some addiction studies. In one, the researchers told subjects to either approach or avoid social media icons on a screen by pressing buttons, like moving a video game character toward a target. In another, they offered longer access to social media, the faster subjects could tap a space bar. After 1 week of effort to avoid social media, subjects were no more likely to gravitate much more or less toward app icons or to mash the keyboard much faster or slower. Overall, the findings showed no change in desire for social media over the week, the researchers reported. What we see with social media is qualitatively different compared to drugs, where craving or compulsive usage would be expected, Eason says. We shouldn't over-pathologize normal behaviors. That's not to say the social media break didn't affect subjects at all. In fact, with less social media usage, subjects experienced a drop in negative emotions. However, positive ones subsided too. You take away that good feeling of seeing how many people liked your photos, Eason says. Not everyone is convinced by the study. 1 week is just not long enough to see consistent or meaningful changes in well-being, Gene Twenge, a psychologist at San Diego State University, said in an email. And 51 people is not enough to get reliable results, she said. Eason says a statistical method determined the study size and that because subjects' emotional changes mostly stabilized after a few days, avoiding social media for a longer time might not change the results much. A few days was also long enough for most subjects to slip back into old habits, at least a little. All but 7 failed to avoid social media entirely. Most, however, significantly cut their usage, from nearly 3.5 hours down to 35 minutes per day on average. And although the numbers crept back up in the 4 monitored days following the detox week, it remained roughly a full hour per day lower than before. This may indicate that a short-term break like this could be a starting point for people looking to cut back on social media, some experts say, even if the mental health impacts of doing so remain uncertain. When you teach people that they could do okay if they used social media for a half an hour a day, they may develop better habits, says Ophir Terrell, an information systems scientist at the University of Melbourne who was not involved in the study. Adopting a new social media diet like this invites a comparison to certain foods, which many experts prefer to the comparison to drugs. You need food to survive, but the quantity and quality of what you eat really matter, Vanden Abela says. Similarly, she says, we often depend on social media for social contact, but it's possible to overdo it. If Instagram is your vice, that's like chocolate cookies, she says. Replacing chocolate cookies with ice cream may defeat the purpose of a diet, however. In the absence of social media, the authors of the new study note, subjects spent more time playing video games and shopping online. Finally, bursts of brain activity during dying could explain life passing before your eyes, by Sarah Reardon in the May 1st Science Online. Many people who have come close to death or have been resuscitated report a similar experience. Their lives flash before their eyes, memorable moments replay, and they may undergo an out-of-body experience, sensing that they're looking at themselves from elsewhere in the room. Now, a small study mapping the brain activity of four people while they were dying shows a burst of activity in their brains after their hearts stop. The authors say the finding may explain how a person's brain could replay conscious memories even after the heart has stopped. It suggests we're identifying a marker of lucid consciousness, says Sam Parnia, a pulmonologist at New York University Langone Medical Center who wasn't involved in the study. Although death has historically been medically defined as the moment when the heart irreversibly stops beating, recent studies have suggested brain activity in many animals and humans can continue for seconds to hours. In 2013, for instance, University of Michigan neurologist Hima Boryegan and his team found that rats' brains showed signs of consciousness up to 30 seconds after their hearts stopped beating. We have this binary concept of life and death that's ancient and outdated, Pardia says. Still, despite the numerous reports over hundreds of years from people who've been resuscitating following clinical death or nearly died, I was shocked to realize we know almost nothing about brain activity during the dying process, Boryegan says. For the current study, she and her team looked at the medical records of four people who were in comas and on life support, on whom physicians had placed electroencephalography caps. None of the patients had any chance of survival. The caps continually monitored the electrical signals moving across the surface of each patient's brain, before and after physicians removed their ventilators, during each patient's last measurable heartbeat, and up until all brain activity had ceased. Seconds after the ventilators were removed, two of the patients' brains suddenly lit up with a burst of neuronal activity in high-frequency patterns called gamma waves that continued as the heart stopped beating. Other studies have found the same pattern when a healthy person is actively recalling a memory, learning, or dreaming, and some neuroscientists have linked these oscillations with consciousness. Ajmal Zamar, a neurosurgeon at the University of Louisville, says gamma waves may signal that different brain regions are working together to combine disparate sensations into the conscious awareness of an object, putting together the sight and smell and sound of a car, for instance. How the brain does this, he says, is one of the biggest mysteries in neuroscience. But seeing the same gamma waves in dying people suggests a biological mechanism for the reports of the brain replaying memorable events in those final moments. His lab previously saw similar gamma waves in one person who died of a heart attack while that person's brain was being monitored for seizures. This paper is really important for the field and the consciousness field more generally, says biomedical scientist Charlotte Martial of the University of Liège, who studies near-death experiences. She's not surprised that only two of the four people in Boryegan's study show the gamma activity, given that not all people who have survived near-death experience report memory recall or out-of-body experiences. Boryegan notes that the two people whose brains showed gamma activity also had a history of seizures, which she says could have primed their brains to experience abnormal rhythms. Her team also called increased electrical activity in a brain region called the temporoparietal-occipital junction, which is believed to be involved in consciousness and is activated during dreaming, seizures, and out-of-body hallucinations. She thinks the burst of brain activity is part of survival mode that the brain is known to enter once it's deprived of oxygen. Studies of animals undergoing brain death have found that the organ begins to release numerous signaling molecules and creates unusual brainwave patterns to try to resuscitate itself, even as it shuts down external signs of consciousness. It shuts the door to the outside world and takes care of internal business because the house is on fire, she says. Boyegan hopes to replicate her findings by collaborating with other medical centers to study brain activity in patients who are dying. Finding some answers to how the dying process occurs would be crucial, Zemar says, because death is sort of a mystery. We don't really know what it is. That's today's look into the science world. Our stories today came from the March 10th New York Times and the November 8th and May 1st issues of Science Online. The Science World is produced at the studios of Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati. Questions or comments should be directed to Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati, 2045 Gilbert Avenue, Cincinnati 45202. Join us next week when we'll again explore the science world. I'm Steve Klaney.